So this is the session on the PDB and molecular visualization. And if you haven't yet, there are handouts up here. And in particular, this has become somewhat famous around here at MSU Parks. I have a tutorial on PineMol, which is a molecular visualization software that's mostly free. And so you guys can take that home. It's similar to the tutorial on Nuplot, where it has you working through some examples and looking at structures on your own. And a good bit of today's session is going to be covering how to use PineMol and some tips and tricks that you might find enjoyable for doing molecular visualization. But before we got into that, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the data stored in the protein data bank. And so generally when a biophysicist or a biochemist determines the structure of a particular protein, they want to publish that obviously in a paper, but they're also going to put the structure or the coordinates into a database of protein and DNA structures. And that's essentially what the protein data bank is. It's just the database of solved protein and DNA and RNA macromolecular structures. And experimentally, as I said yesterday, we don't have a whole lot of time to get into the details of how these are determined. But generally speaking, you find two main ways for solving protein and DNA structures in the PDB. The first way is going to be X-ray crystallography. And so what you do in X-ray crystallography is you have to basically crystallize your protein using specific solution conditions. And then once you have a crystal, you can put it in from an X-ray beam, and the lattice of atoms in the crystal diffracts the X-ray beam in a way where you can back calculate what your atomic coordinates are based on the observed scattering pattern. And because of that, it's typically more precise. You usually get resolutions in the angstrom range, and so an angstrom, remember, is 10 to the 10th meters. And we'll talk about the assessing crystal structures here in the next couple of slides, but because you're getting actual atomic coordinates in an X-ray structure, those data are usually a little bit more reliable, or the most reliable method that you have. The challenge with X-ray crystallography is that it's not always easy to crystallize a protein. Proteins are not like salt, where you just let the system evaporate and over time crystals will form. Instead, you often have to do hundreds and sometimes thousands of different trials to find the right conditions where your protein will form crystals that diffract well. And so it's challenging, but if you can get crystals, you're almost guaranteed a structure at this point. It used to be that crystallization was a little bit harder to do for large molecular systems, but these days with synchrotron X-ray sources and advanced software that's been developed, it's pretty straightforward to get a crystal structure once you have a crystal that diffracts. The other major method that people use to solve protein structures in NMR, so nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, and as I said yesterday, this is basically a method of attaining constraints between different atoms, usually hydrogen atoms, in a protein or a DNA molecule. So you might say that this hydrogen atom is 3 angstroms away from this hydrogen atom, and the other hydrogen atom is maybe 6 angstroms away from this other hydrogen atom. And if you add up enough constraints like that, you can eventually calculate from geometric principles what your molecular structure has to be. There's other types of constraints that can go into NMR. The distance constraints are the easiest to understand. But there are also ways to correlate, for example, chemical shifts, so the actual spectral peak positions themselves, to the backbone torsion angles. So we learned yesterday during our lens talk that the backbone has a phi and psi angle. And if you know enough chemical shifts, you can often predict what the phi and psi angle are with a pretty good degree of accuracy. There's other types of files in the PDB. More and more you have cryo-electron microscopy, where people have published sort of models based on very low electron diffraction that you can get from specialized electron microscopes. So that's a very small portion, but occasionally you'll see a large complex solved that way. Sometimes you'll see people putting their model data in, but that's been pretty much discouraged now. There's other databases for simulations or for models. And just to give you a breakdown of what the current PDB looks like, 120,000 structures total, and of those, 107,000 are crystal structures. And the vast majority of the rest of them, the other, you know, 15,000 or so, is 12,000 or so, are NMR structures, and then there's maybe a couple hundred tops for the remaining categories. So when you build an X-ray structure, oftentimes, you know, again, this is all done with a lot of computer-aided modeling at this point. But this is a way to sort of visualize what this looks like. Essentially, the computer calculates an electron density here, which is demonstrated by this sort of blocky grid. And if I had more time, I might make one of these myself, but you can actually go and make your own little electron density. But essentially what you see is this grid represents the density of electrons mapped onto three-dimensional space. And then what the experimentalist is doing is they're fitting the atomic positions into the electron density as displayed. So this is DNA for guanine. And you can see that, you know, the guanine actually fits quite nicely into the electron density that's back calculated from the scattering profile. I don't have a picture of the raw data here from X-ray, but yeah, if we covered more X-ray detail, we would have that. And anyway, you can also see that, you know, depending on the quality of data, you can also have a poorer fit versus a better fit. So one thing to keep in mind whenever you look at a protein structure is that it is a model. It's a model that's just like the nuplot models we talked about yesterday. It's a model that's based on experimental data, and it sort of gives you the best agreement between where you think the atomic position should be and what the experimental data actually say. and so you can sort of see how this model fitting, so to speak, is happening. You're basically trying to fit atomic positions into the data that you calculate. You can use molecular mechanics in here to help refine your slides. I mean, you know, we know what a guanine looks like, so we know that it's a planar aromatic type of a ring, so we expect that those atoms will be on the same plane. So you can use chemical and physical principles when you do these types of calculations, and often that's what's done. There's some kind of simulation going on at the same time that you're refining your data. And obviously because this is a model fit, you know, there's going to be good models and there's going to be bad models. And I'm not saying that every old model from the 1980s, I mean, the first crystal structure, I believe, was hemoglobin, which was John Kendrew and Max Perutz, and they won the Nobel Prize for it. Or not, I think it was myoglobin, I'm sorry. And so that was back in the 50s and 60s that they were working on that, right? So we've had crystallography of macromolecules for a long time. And you know, as the years go by, we develop better ways to refine structures, better ways to assess the agreement between the experimental data and the observations. And so, you know, again, I'm not saying that every structure collected before 1980 is garbage, but you've got to keep in mind that a structure collected 30 years ago probably wasn't being held to the same standards that a structure being submitted in 2016 will be held to. And so that's one thing, just looking at the time, you can sort of assess whether that structure is good. Now the best crystal structures hold up over time. And so, you know, the calmodulin structure that we look at today, the Heneg lysozyme structure that we look at today, is largely unchanged from the Heneg lysozyme structure that was in there 15 years ago. So, you know, there's certainly places where very good data has held up over time. But if you have two structures, one was collected 30 years ago, one was collected in, you know, 2010, one thing you might want to look at is the one that's gone through the more rigorous screening that would have taken place in 2010. Other types of things to consider, and so oftentimes an X-ray crystallography or X-ray crystal structure will come along with several different additional numbers. So those are going to be R factor, R free, resolution, there'll be a validation thing which we briefly looked at, and then the number of waters. And so briefly, you know, refinement factor is something similar to what we talked about like yesterday with chi-square. Okay, so it's an agreement of it's a measurement of the agreement between the model and the observed scattering profile that you get. And so that's what the R stands for. Generally, if you see an R factor in a crystal structure, you want to see something ideally less than 25%. 25 to 30% is okay, and the lower you get, the better. But think of chi-square. You want that number to be low as possible to represent the best agreement that you can have. R-free, again, that's one of those things I think it was developed back in the early 90s as a concept. And so structures published before 1990 aren't going to have an R-free. But essentially what they were finding was that the refinement factor, it was easy to overfit your data. So you basically use all of your data and you try to generate the best crystal structure possible and you get the optimal agreement. But it wasn't reflecting the actual uncertainty in the data itself. And so what they would do for the R-free is they would refine the structure, but they would take out some of the data first so that they weren't refining it against that data. And then they would, once they finished their structure calculations, they would go back and see how well their final structure calculations predict the data that they left out. And so it's a way of cross-validating what the actual data looks like. And so, generally speaking, the R-free is always going to be bigger than the R, but the lower the number there is, the better. And so that's basically the measurement of disagreement between your calculated model and the data that you left out initially. Resolution, again, just like you know, you think of high-resolution optics or you know, high-resolution anything, you know, from an advertising point of view. But here, you know, resolution lower is better. Resolution is basically the measure of the smallest distance that you can differentiate in your model. Okay, and so if I can differentiate one angstroms, that means I can tell, okay, there's an atom out here at one angstrom, and I know it's different from the atom over here that's one angstrom away. Okay, so the one angstrom is telling you, you know, to some degree, what you can differentiate, the distance, the smallest distance that you can differentiate in your structure. So obviously, lower is better. 2.5 angstroms is sort of a good starting point if you want to really make, you know, structural inferences and hypotheses about what you're looking at, but you know, if you're just trying to understand the viral capsid and you're looking at something that's 40,000 angstroms in you know, diameter or something like that, you might not need that high of a resolution just to understand, you know, the architecture of the plasmid or the capsid itself. And so some viral capsids I think have been solved to 5-6 angstroms. I think the initial ribosome structure was in the 3-4 angstrom range, and it's still got, you know, the Nature and the Science publication. So think about what you need, but generally for the work that we do, we often want to think about less than 2.5 angstroms, and 1.5 angstrom is usually quite good if you can get that. At about 1 angstrom, your hydrogens become visible, and so one thing you'll notice from the structures that we look at today that are crystal structures, there will be no hydrogens on any of the structures that we look at. And that's because there's no data for the hydrogens. The hydrogens, you know, they're small, and you know, the atomic radius of a hydrogen is about 1 angstrom, and they only have, you know, 1 electron cloud around them, right? I mean, I guess 2 if you count covalent bonding. And so in thinking about the electrons scattering light, the hydrogens have the least number of electrons that can actually contribute to the scattering signal that we measure in X-ray crystallography. And so you really don't start to see hydrogens until you get to be very, very high resolution. Obviously, you know, we know that generally steric clash is a bad thing. So if the structure has steric clash, that's usually a sign that it's a less good structure. If the torsion angles, the phi psi torsion angles, fall outside of where the Ramachandran plot would predict them to be, that's another indicator that maybe your structure isn't as good as it could be. And people have shown that, again, comparing older structures with lots of torsion angle outliers, that is, torsion angles that you wouldn't think would be allowed, they can be re-refined and actually produce much better results today using more modern approaches. And so there's really no reason, it's not like those bad torsion angles are really bad for a chemical reason. I mean, occasionally that happens, but most of the time when you have a structure with a lot of bad torsion angles, it's because the experimental data wasn't refined as well as it could be. And then another thing, again, this gets into the theory of crystallography, but going back to this, you can see that even in our high quality structure, or our high quality fit, there's sort of sections of electron density that are not filled by atoms, right? And so,
So what resolution is that?
This, I would say this is probably about, you can see here, you can refine the middle of that phenol ring, or that, I don't know what it would be on a glossy. And so I'd say this is probably about 1.6 amperes. I think this bond length is going to be about 1.2, 1.4 angstroms. And I believe that means that if you can differentiate the hole from the edges, that's about 1.6 angstroms. I think. And that's just looking at it and bringing experience into the mix. But you can see there's density here. Electron density that hasn't been placed with atoms. And so sometimes what experimentalists will do is they'll put water molecules in there, and that will increase the agreement between the observed and the experimental structure, or the calculated versus the experimental structure or the experimental data. But it's not a meaningful increase in agreement. You're basically just filling up electron density with water molecules that may or may not actually be there. And so from the perspective of looking at the waters, if you download a structure where there's hundreds and thousands of waters all around, it probably means that there was a lot of unexplained density that the experimentalists had no other choice but to fill that density with water molecules. And so for a 6-kilodalton protein, you probably want something between 12 and 30 water molecules in the PDB structure. And you'll see when we start opening up PIMOL and PDBs where this comes into play. So these are your quick guidelines. Again, you already have the website of this is just the exact same slide, but this is just a review of where that web page is. And just a couple of examples. And so we can go here to the PDB, and we'll open up 3TJW. And one interesting thing, all PDB identifiers to date are just 4-letter codes. And I'm not sure, at the rate at which we're growing, I don't think that'll be a problem in the near future. But when you consider that all of the other databases use like 6, 7, 8-letter codes, it is kind of interesting that PDB is only using 4. And generally there's some restrictions. So usually this one is always a number, and then you have more freedom on the other ones. Okay, so this is a protein. This is the villain headpiece. And so this is just an example. This is a rather high resolution protein structure. And essentially, this is one of the smallest, I think it might be the smallest single domain folder that has been identified. So this protein essentially is just three helices coming together in a bundle. If you notice, there's no connectors between the helices because they don't see the crystal, they don't see the data for that, so they don't put the atoms in there that they don't see. And this thing has been shown to fold, I think, in the order of a few, maybe 10 to 100 microseconds. So it's a very fast folder. That's one of the reasons people are interested in it. And you can see that there's several different things. So if I look here, here's the validation window. And so you can compare things like the R3. And so it shows what this particular structure is going to be, and how that compares. So you might not be able to read it from here, but the black bar is percentile relative to all other crystal structures. And so the R3 of 0.19, actually it puts it in the very highest percentile of structures. And compared to other structures of the same resolution, which is the open bar, it's actually even doing, it's not doing quite as good, but it's still doing pretty well. Clash score, on average it's better, but when you compare it to other structures of 1.46 angstroms, it's about average. And so you can use that information, sidechain and Ramachandran outliers, so sidechain and backbone torsion angle outliers, they're zero, so that means it's quite good there. And I don't really know what the RSRZ outlier is. I've never really bothered to look that up. But apparently it's not doing as well there. you can see the resolution is given right here on the front page of the PDB. The R-free is 19%. The R-value, so the total refinement value, is 15%. So very good structure overall. And so that means that the experimental data represents a good agreement with the scattering you calculate from these atomic positions. Does that mean that this is a good model of your protein? That's a harder question, right? Because for a while the highest resolution structure I think was Crambin, and it was solved in some kind of mixture of hexanol, right? And so if you think of, hexanol might make it, your crystallize really well, and you might get really accurate atomic positions, but you and I don't have hexanol in our bloodstream, right? So you have to think about things like that. This is a model, it's solved under certain conditions. Most of these crystal structures are solved at temperatures of like 100 Kelvin, which are quite a bit colder than what we would normally see. The reason they do that is to reduce atomic motions, right? So they reduce the atomic motions and they get the atoms to stay still so they can get the nice high resolution structure and publish in Nature. And so you've got to think about those types of considerations when you're looking at a structure like this. One of my old advisors used to say that seeing is deceiving. And so by looking at the structure, you get this feeling that, oh yeah, we really know what the chemical coordinates are of these things, but there might be other considerations at play that mean that even though this is a very good agreement with the data that was observed, maybe those conditions aren't as relevant. So that's something you guys have got to think about when you look at structures like these. Most of the time, people have shown, you change the temperature, the structure doesn't change that much. But think about what types of interpretation you're making. If your hypothesis is absolutely dependent on this side chain being in exactly this conformation, and making this precise hydrogen bond, and if that doesn't happen, then your whole model is thrown to pot. Well then, this might, you really need to make sure you're getting structural data that supports that. And maybe 100 Kelvin isn't gonna be the right data for you. But it's not like this protein totally changes conformation when you raise it to room temperature. It's gonna be mostly the same. Okay, so that sort of covers this. There's also information here. So, we saw on the website where the R3 was. This used to be organized a little bit differently. Yeah, they used to have a nice little little box on the side of the structure that would show you what the experimental details were. And maybe that's still hidden there somewhere. And again, the problem is with these websites is that they often will change things without any rhyme or reason, just to give the web developers something to do. But here you can get information on the experimental techniques. So what pH was it done? This actually said it was at 298 Kelvin, which is kind of cool. Okay, so that's cool. But other information about data collection, again, this is all very technical stuff that we're not going to spend our time on. Let's look at a different crystal structure. So this is a protein called staphylococcal nuclease. This is a protein that I worked on a little bit as a postdoc. And so this one has a code of 1SNC. Okay, so you can see this is an older structure. It was deposited in 1989. And so there's no R3, just an R value. And so the R value is 16%. Resolution is 1.6 angstrom. So actually pretty good if you look at those two. And yet, if you look here at clash score sidechain outliers, those are actually quite poor compared to the rest of the PDB. And this is sort of, this demonstrates sort of this increasing level of scrutiny that's been applied to structures that are submitted to the PDB. Back in 1990, it was really important. People realized, hey, Ramachandran plots are real things. We should make sure our structure doesn't have any Ramachandran outliers. But some of these other things like clash score and sidechain distributions hadn't been studied at the same level of detail yet. And so this is a structure that doesn't have as tightly controlled limits on clash score and sidechain outliers. And so if you're really interested in the sidechains of this protein, you might want to just step back a second and make sure that the data really agree. And you can actually download the electron density of this and look at it in PIMAL, which is pretty cool. This might be telling you, hey, red flag here, make sure you actually understand what you're looking at before you overinterpret the data. Okay, so if you want to go into our database here, and we did this a little bit yesterday, but I don't think we did it probably justice. But when you click on this download files, and again, this button has changed locations probably 2-3 times in the last 3 years. So, but it's always going to be download. And when you click on it, again, for the last 5 years or so, it's had this type of a format. You can download several types of things. The PDB format is just the easiest. It's the text file version. The GZIP is a compressed version if you really have a trouble transferring 100 kilobytes over your internet connection, but nobody's really in that position anymore. So if you download the PDB format, again, I have PIMAL installed, so it's going to ask me to just open it this way. But if I save that file to my desktop and open it up, unfortunately, we learned all about Linux. But Linux and Microsoft and Mac all have slightly different ways of storing text files. And so if I were to open this up in Notepad, just to show you what that looks like, because you would think, Notepad, that's what I should use to view text files. Again, it comes up, but all of the line breaks are screwed up. So this is supposed to be like a multi-line file. But Notepad doesn't understand the Linux line break. And there's easy ways to convert back and forth, but you can Google those yourself. For me, I find that the easiest way to handle this is just to go into WordPad, which seems to be able to handle both types of line breaks. And so if I open up that file again, this time in WordPad, Now it's going to show me everything. And if I really want to get rid of the word, the line wrapping, and it's not going to let me do that one. Well, that's good enough. Is it? Yeah, no, not really. So I'm still getting that one line wrapped. Let's see. Good old word wrap, no wrap. Hey, there we go. Look at that. Okay, so this is a PDB file. And the general format of a PDB file, you can actually look this up on the internet if you're really curious. But every line represents sort of a different entry in the PDB file. And the first six characters of the line, so in this case, revdat, tells you something specific about what type of information is contained on that line. And so up here at the top, again, this protein is staphylococcal nuclease, so it hydrolyzes DNA. And so the header is up here, you know, has the original date of submission, the actual PDB identifier, the four-letter code, the title of the file, the crystal structure and ternary complex of staphylococcal nuclease, calcium, and the inhibitor PD*TP, refined at 1.65 angstroms. You can see there's ways for it to continue this on multiple lines because it doesn't want to go beyond a certain character limit. But every one of these, you know, this first six characters are special. And they tell you what kind of information is being contained on that particular line. Obviously, there's all sorts of stuff in here. You can see there's a publication that it was published in. If you scroll down, you know, there's a whole bunch of remarks here that contain information about, you know, the experimental conditions under which the solution or the structure was solved. Again, a lot of this stuff is beyond our scope here. You know, there's a listing of all the three-letter codes for the sequence. So again, so that information is stored in there conveniently. And then eventually you get down to these lines which start with atom. And so the atom lines are basically storing the three-dimensional coordinates, the XYZ coordinates, of every atom in the structure. So if the protein has 1,000 atoms, there's going to be 1,000 atom entries. And you can see that there's a, you know, this, even if you don't really know what the format of the PDB is, you can see, okay, well, the first residue stored in the PDB file is a leucine. The second residue appears to be a histidine. This column here stores the residue number. So this is leucine 7 and histidine 8. Every atom has a specific name. So the backbone has an N, a C alpha, a C and an O, and then C beta, C gamma, C delta as you go down the chain. These numbers just increase sequentially, so they represent like the atom record number. And then over here, you have your X and your Y and your Z coordinate given in angstroms. And these are, you know, this is a geometric situation, right? If you want to calculate the distance between this atom and this atom, you just use your, you know, X squared, Y squared, Z squared type of positioning to calculate the distance between two atoms in space. And so these three columns are your coordinate positions. This column is called occupancy. And so sometimes you'll see in a crystal structure, they might actually determine that there's two conformations. And so one might be 50%, one might be 50% another way. So maybe this leucine might have a conformation pointing this way and a conformation pointing this way. And so it can give an occupancy, and then you'll see basically, you'll see two identifiers here for leucine 7. You'll see one for the first one and one for the second one. And then temperature factor, which again, we're not going to talk about, but this is representing, it's an estimate, and it's a very rough estimate, on how disordered those atomic positions are. And so this goes from 0 to 100, and the lower the number is, the lower the temperature of those atoms, or the less motion that they're observed to contain. But this is a big farce. So, because people have shown that, that these numbers can represent anything from very tightly constrained motion to motion that essentially is random and goes over like 7 or 8 angstroms. And so you really have to be careful when you're interpreting those. And that's why we're not going to talk about it, because I think it's more subtle than we can get into. Here at the end, you scroll down again, there's lots of atoms. Eventually, you start to reach things that don't look like proteins. And so these are called heteroatoms. And remember that the title of this thing was In Complex with PD star TP. Right? So we'll see when we actually open this guy up that there's a small molecule that's binding to this protein. And they've called it THP here. And you can see it has the same format as the other lines. It just has the heteroatom part in the front. And then eventually, if you scroll down even farther, you get to the waters. And so these are oxygens. Again, you don't see hydrogens in this structure. And so you see HOH, HOH, HOH. And these are just water molecules that they've added in the structure itself. Okay, so we'll touch more on Pymol in a second, but what does this look like when it's being rendered? And so that's what we're seeing here. And so this is the protein. Again, notice that there wasn't a whole lot. I mean, there's some information about bond connectivities in the PDB file, but most of the reason that, you know, this Pymol knows to connect this atom to this atom to this atom is Pymol has an idea of what molecule bonding should be like. And so it looks at the three-dimensional coordinates and draws lines based on what it thinks the bonding should be. These little red crosses, if I zoom in here, you can see there's a whole bunch of these little red X's. Those are the water molecules that are being filled in. And so you can sort of see that they're basically around the periphery. Many of them may be sort of static water molecules that are associated with hydrogen bonding to the protein itself, but some of them might be additional just density-filling hydrogen or water molecules. And again, it gives different colors to the different nuclei. So this nitrogen is usually blue, oxygen is red, and carbon in this representation is drawn green. Okay, so we'll touch more on the actual theory behind Pymol, but let's show you what that so now you can see the water molecules really well. And then let's show sticks. Okay, so now I'm showing as stick representations all of the heteroatoms. Now the water molecules are separate, so it's really hard to draw a stick when you only have one atom. But you can see this is that small molecule, that PD star TAP or whatever it is, that binds here. It's a nucleoside analog. So staphylococcal nucleus is involved in bacterial warfare. And so I forget if it's methylated or non-methylated, but bacteria methylate their genomes to sort of protect themselves. And if it finds that there's non-methylated DNA, either from a bacteriophage or some kind of other contaminant that's inside the cell somehow, a protein like staphylococcal nuclease will cut it up and sort of prevent it from being recombined into the bacteria's genome, and thus protect it from foreign genes coming into the bacteria. And like I said, I might have mixed up the methyl versus the non-methyl, I'm not sure. But this is a little guy that basically binds at the active site and looks enough like nucleotide that the molecule, that the protein binds to it. Okay. So how do we get this program? So Pymol is obviously a tool that takes those three-dimensional coordinates and makes it easy to visualize. And so, again, if you haven't picked it up, I recommend the Beginner's Guide to Pi Mole. It has a lot of this information in it. And there's a couple of ways to get it. Pi Mole was actually written by a guy named Warren Delano, who had been up at Yale. I mean, he wasn't a PI, but he was a staff scientist. And he was a very, very nice man. I met him several times. And his goal at the time was to come up with scientific software that people could actually use and would be available for free, but would be stable enough that you could still use it. And if you wanted support, you would basically subscribe and pay him to support your software or help you if you have rendering problems. Unfortunately, that model, the free model doesn't really work. I wish it did. He passed away several years ago, maybe about when I was just about finishing up graduate school. And as a result, Pi Mole was obtained by a company called Schrodinger. And they have sort of kept his original desire of keeping the Pi Mole available and for free, but they're still open source Pi Mole, and so Warren released the software into the public domain, so you can always compile it yourself. But as the years have gone by, Schrodinger has gotten less and less permissive about what they'll allow educational users to do for free. And so when I first started working here, you could use the software, but all of the features weren't enabled, and it was occasionally there were one or two bugs. And again, they figured, well, then we're not paying for it. Fixing those bugs isn't a high priority. As of last year, the educational release has more bugs, and what I would consider critical features have been removed. And so you can still get it for free. There's the website, but my recommendation is to use an older version, which I have links to in here and on the PDF of the tutorial. And so I usually recommend 1.31, and that version seems to me the best. It's new enough that you can install it on Windows 7 or Mac easily. But it's old enough that it hasn't had the same kind of crippling Schrodinger modifications to it. And unfortunately, I only see that really becoming more and more of a problem here in the future. And so there are the links for downloading Pi Mole. So I have Windows, Mac, and Linux version. These are the Schrodinger distributable packages. So I basically just put them on my own server just in case Schrodinger decided they wanted to hide them or take them off the internet. And because Pi Mole is open source, you can always, there's multiple ways to obtain it. And generally, for when I'm doing my work, I'll use Linux because I don't have time to compile Pi Mole myself, but there's all sorts of people out there who do, and they put it into Linux distributions so that you can just easily install a non-crippled version that doesn't have quite all the features that it would if you had from Schrodinger, but because Warren didn't cripple the software, the version that you can install on Ubuntu or Debian doesn't have those crippled either. And so this is generally what I do, but again, it requires you to have access to a Linux system. And that's what I said there. I don't have a lot of positive things to say about Schrodinger, but since this is being recorded and put on the internet, I'm not going to say them. But there are alternatives to Pi Mole, and so if the trend of crippling and buggy software continues, probably in future boot camps I might switch to the UCSF Chimera. And so these are all free. You can download them, but Chimera is almost as user friendly as Pi Mole, but it's a little bit trickier in terms of visualizing, particularly DNA, and it's not quite as user-friendly. VMD is another free package, but it's optimized mostly for looking at MD simulations, and so since you guys don't generally come up with this or do MD, you know, it's probably better to not focus on it. Molescript is fabulous if you know how to program and you don't mind editing text files and hacking around with old code. I think Molescript is still hands down the best program for generating images, but it's just very difficult to use if you're not really entrenched in the Linux environment. You can find more about the history of molecular visualization at that website. It is a rich history. It's interesting to me, but probably not to a whole lot of other people. And that's why we mostly just talk about PIMOL. You know, I as much as I dislike some of the changes that have been made to PIMOL, I think it's still hands down the most user-friendly, the most accessible, and the most featured program out there. And so that's why we're sticking with it for this presentation. Okay, so there's our summary. Let's take a look at what you can actually do with PIMOL. Okay, so again, I think let's just stick with what do we got here? We wrap up at 4, right, Becca? Or 3:50?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with staph nuclease again. And we'll go in here and we'll show you what some of the features are of this. And so again, this is going to be similar to what we did with Nuplot yesterday. I'm not going to go into quite the detail that's covered in the tutorial, but I figure I already spent hours working on the tutorial. You guys can read it and learn that yourself. But I will cover most of the basics. And so when you open PIMOL on a PC and on Linux, it's going to give you two windows. Your window up here is sort of like your traditional window with the file edit, yada, 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 types of stuff going on. There's information here. So when it opens up a PDB file, it shows some of those top lines. And so if you were paying attention, you might remember that, hey, look, this looks kind of familiar. So it does show you some of that information up here. It doesn't show you the whole PDB file, so that's nice. And then there's a command line here. And so this is another sort of command line driven tool. And while you can use your mouse and do lots of nice things with PIMOL as far as dragging the molecule around, ultimately most of what you're going to be doing is going to be typing into the command line and changing the appearance of your structure that way. And so so that's the command line up here. There's other types of commands. I mean, not everything you have to type. But if you want to reset your view, you can zoom out, zoom in. I mean, it's already at the normal view. So you can go through this. PIMOL does have ways to generate movies. It's not as intuitive, and I've never really learned how, because I've never had to make a big movie. But some simple things, like if you click on this rock button, you can mesmerize your audience by having your structure rock back and forth. I mean, seriously, you guys can probably watch that for the next 20 minutes.
That could be a screensaver.
Yeah, it is. And the advantage of this is that if you're just looking at the structure on the screen without any motion, it's hard to get a perception of depth, right? So you can't tell what atoms are up front, what atoms are in the back. I mean, they color some of the atoms and give some artificial depth cueing. But this lets you really see, okay, no, this carbon here is really coming from the back of the molecule, whereas this carbon up here is from the front. And so there's advantages to this kind of a rocking motion besides just putting your audience to sleep. You can click that again and turn it off. But the main bulk of your window is going to be here in the sort of, the GUI window. And so what you have here is, again, this is rescalable. You can make it big, you can make it small. But in this black area, you have the molecule itself. On the right-hand side, you have a list
of molecular objects that you've opened. And right now, we've only opened one SNC, right? So there's only one thing here. If I wanted to, we could download another one. Let's do that. We can go here. So let's download. So there's another version of staphylococcal nuclease called 1STN. Okay. We can go and we can download this one too. We'll just save it. So back in the early days, you had the luxury of picking the four-letter code that would actually give you something that resembles your protein name. But nowadays, I think they just assign them at random. But once we have this other PDB file, we can go here, we can open that, and we'll go to the desktop, and you'll see there's 1STN, open that. And now now you can essentially see that you have two models over here on the right. They both actually look pretty similar, and they're both fairly well overlaid. We'll see what to do later when that doesn't happen. This 1STN does not have, if you look over here, this is our drug molecule again. So 1STN doesn't have that. It just has an open active site. And now over here, if I click on things here in my list of molecular objects, I can turn them on and off very easily. So if I don't want to look at 1SNC for some reason, I can click on that. I can click on it again and switch to the other molecule. I can click all and it'll toggle them off and on. So easy to manipulate there. I have four little buttons here. So A is action, S is show, H is hide, L is label, and C is color. And so you can see that there's different options in here. Right now we're looking at what's called the sticks representation, or the lines representation, obviously because they just draw lines between atoms. But there's other ways that people have decided that they can represent molecules. So one way would be like van der Waals spheres. And so we could go here to show, and I believe, yep, if I go to spheres, you can see that this now draws the van der Waals spheres. And again, roughly estimating atoms by their largest S orbital, right? So that's a pretty good approximation. You can see that your waters are still here, so we still have the waters. I've often wondered about this one. I mean, clearly that's not the protein, right? And there's no physical justification for it to be there. This was the Ed Lattman structure. I wanted to ask him about that for a while. But he's no longer doing a whole lot of science. He's now an administrator. But he was a faculty member when I was a graduate student and obviously worked on this structure. So you can see that despite the fact that the protein itself, when you look at it, if I go and hide the spheres, it looks like, well, maybe there's a lot of empty space here. Just looking at that representation, no. There's really not a whole lot of empty space here. It's quite well packed. Other representations out there, if I hide the spheres again.
Could you put the spheres on and like toggle up the active site?
What do you mean toggle the active site?
Or just like, so you put the spheres on and put it where we can see the active site?
Sure. Actually, to make that easier, what I'm going to do, again, I'm going to cheat, so I'm going to use the command line. So I'm going to show sticks, head at them. So there's your drug that's binding at the active site. Another useful thing I'm going to do is go here to action, remove waters. A lot of times you don't care about the waters. They're just there for the crystallographer. And so I'm going to click on remove waters, and that gets rid of those. And now if I go show spheres, I think I'm going to have to hide that again. So let's hide spheres. Head at them. There we go. So now you can see where the active site is. And again, just to show you some, so let's color yellow. Okay, so now you can sort of see what molecules or what the active site looks like and how tightly that little guy fits in there. This is currently, this is being drawn in moderate quality. One of the things that I like to do is turn up, this is just drawing spheres, right? Most graphics cards can do that in their sleep. So if I go here to display quality, I can switch to maximum quality. And now it starts to add a little bit of reflections on the surface. You can see that the spheres look a little bit cleaner. If I really want to put something together for publication, I would type ray. And so what this does, it actually does a simulation of how the rays of light would come and reflect off this molecular surface. And so if I type ray and hit enter, so now it's actually doing calculations of shadows, and you can see the quality is going up. But now at this point I can't move it around, right? This is a static image. If I try to move it again, it switches back to my high quality. And you can see even on this video card, it's a little hard to keep up with this quality. If I want a high resolution ray traced image, so suppose right now it defaults to whatever the size of my screen is, I can go and I can type ray, and I can type, let's do 1500. That's probably a good number. That's not going to take too long. And so I'm saying, hey, calculate my ray traced image with the x-axis being 1500 pixels. And now you can see there's not 1500 pixels on the screen, so it's just showing you a smaller version. But then I can now save this as an image. And so if I go up, that's probably gonna undo it. Let's try that again. So if I ray trace this again, 1500, you can see it takes a little time to do that calculation. That's interesting. And now if I do file save image as PNG, and so now you can see I can then open that up in an image viewer. So if you're really good with Photoshop or some other type of molecular or some other type of graphic software, you can then go in and edit this. Other types of options that, if you're thinking about trying to make it look cool, which I think is always nice. It's helpful to make images look cool, but then are also helpful. You can change the background. So if I, if I have a slide that's going to be white, maybe I don't want the big black background. And so now when I ray trace it, it'll look, again, now it's easy to cut and put onto a white background slide. And so obviously PyMol has the ability to make things look very nice and show off things like what you think the active site should look like. This is drawing spheres. I remember somebody had asked about surfaces. So if I hide my spheres, one of the options here under show, maybe it's not under show. Oh, there it is. So now it has to take some time to do some calculation. But this is essentially sort of connecting the dots of where it thinks the molecular surface would look like. And it's doing that based on what's being displayed as spheres. And so now it doesn't look like spheres anymore, but it looks at like something that you might actually see on a molecular surface or some kind of globule.
Can you do the ray on that?
Yep, you can. right? So you can, I mean, there's all sorts of neat things that you can do here. One of the things that you'll occasionally see, let's see, set. So if I go here to my settings list, pretty sure that there's a, yeah, maybe I have to do it manually. So I can go here. Suppose I want to have something where I have my, actually, let's do this. Okay, so we'll just show you some cool examples of figures that you can make. So let's hide the surface. All right, and let's show, so one of the other representations that you can do here is cartoon. So again, that sort of brings the traditional view of helices and sheets up. And we can hide the line representation because oftentimes that's just getting in the way. And one of the things you might have noticed if you've been watching me type is that I've been typing sort of show and hide commands, but then I've been giving PyMOL a specific sort of selection on what to do with those commands. And so I might not want to show spheres for everything. I might want to just show spheres for a particular set of atoms. And so if I do that, like for example, if I want to show spheres for my heteroatoms, show spheres atom. So all I have to do, so I can press the up arrow again. There's some nice thing. I basically put a comma, and then I can put a selection string in here. And so heteroatom is one of the common selection strings within PyMOL. There's all sorts of selection strings, right? So if I want to, instead of showing sticks for the heteroatoms, show sticks for residue 15. So I can say show sticks, comma, residue 15, resi 15. And that says, hey, show this for residue 15. And now you can see that residue 15 shows up at stick representation. Okay, that there's all sorts of options for this. So if I want to do instead, if I want to show all of the lysines, res n stands for residue name. And so I could type res n lyse. And now it shows the sticks for all of the lysine residues. Okay, there's other types of things I can do too. So suppose I want to, so let's hide our stick representation now. Hide sticks. Let's show sticks for, let's do isoleucine residues and res-E greater than 15. Now, apparently there's no isoleucine residues with, no, maybe not. I thought that was allowed, but apparently it isn't. So I can go up here and look to see if it's complaining at me. So up here in this other window, it sort of has an information window that tells me if I'm getting an error. And so if I type an invalid selection expression, it's going to complain and give me an error up here. So apparently there's not an easy way to do that. I'm sure there is a way to do it. I wonder if it's GT. Yeah, I didn't like that one either. One of the things that PyMOL does have is it has a help system. And so if you're in this window, you can always hit escape, and the graphics go away, and now you can see all of the sort of messages that you've typed over the past however many commands. Right? And so, and one thing I can do now is let's type help selection, And here's all the different type ways that you can select atoms and residues in PyMOL. And you can select them by atom names, residue indices, chain identifiers. You can select by element type. You have a B factor. There's all sorts of things that you could go and do for this. But I'm not seeing less than or greater than. So that's probably something I would have to Google to find out. If you want to make for yourself a predefined selection, you can do that easily too. And so if I go up here, so I can hit escape again, bring my graphics back. Suppose I want to start referring to this by residue number. I can click on it, and you can see I'm in I have my selection appear over here in the window. And so now I have a new selection that consists of, this particular drug molecule. I go up here, there's some information about, this is the THP molecule. Apparently it's residue 151. I forgot that looks pretty bad up there. And the atom name is O1P. And so there's, you can access the names of atoms, the names of residues, and the indices of atoms and residues using the PyMOL interface by clicking around and sort of seeing what shows up. And so another way to select these atoms would be select, I think they said 151, right? Yep, 151. Well, let's do it simple first. So I'll color, let's color gray. Resi 151 and all carbon elements. Okay, so now I've basically done the same thing. Instead of referring to this as a heteroatom, I've referred to it by its actual residue index. And so this is residue 151. I've colored all of the carbon elements in residue 151 gray. If I want to refer to that later on, without having to type, resi 151 all the time, I can create for myself a selection object. And if I want to just call it drug, so if I type select drug and then give it a selection string, now I've defined that as a selection up here, and now I no longer have to go in and type resin 151 if I want to refer to that drug. And so this isn't so useful for here, but let's say select, and we'll call it alpha, and we'll say name C alpha. So this will select all of the alpha carbons on residues. And residue name, let's do hydrophobic residues. So let's do isoleucine. And you can use the plus sign to represent sort of or. So residue isoleucine, leucine, and valine. And so this will select all of the alpha carbons on isoleucine, leucine, and valine residues. And it creates a selection called alpha here. And now if I want to show those as spheres, now I can go here and hit show spheres. That's one way to do it. Or I could also type show spheres and just call it by name as alpha. And both ways work pretty well. So the selection tool is very useful for defining predetermined selections that you might want to go back and color and draw on later on. Let's see. Other types of things that you might want to do here with PyMOL. Again, if you go here to Wizard, there's an option called Measurement. And so PyMOL can measure different types of things. I mean, these are just geometric coordinates in space. And so if you want to measure the distance between two atoms, you can go to Wizard Measurement. And if I click on the first atom, And the second atom, again, I'm using my right mouse button to zoom in. And so it says that that's 13.8 angstroms. If I want to measure angles, I can do that too. So if I click on this and hit measure angles, now it needs three atoms. So I'll give it click, click, click. So you can say that's a 48.2 degree angle. And so pi mole can be very quantitative. If you're looking at a structure and you're saying, well, I think this residue interacts or has some kind of interaction with this residue over here. Let's measure the distance, and now I can see, okay, if that distance is maybe 10 angstroms or less, you might be able to say, yeah, that makes sense. Those two residues could be doing something or have an effect on each other. If they're 50 angstroms away, it's probably harder to argue that. But doing these types of measurements, you know, lets you use pi mole not just as a visualization tool to show pretty pictures, but you can actually go in and do some analysis as well. And so one of the things that I typically like to do, let's hide spheres again. And I can delete all my measurements here by clicking this button. And let's show our drug. And suppose I want to select all of the residues that touch this drug, right? So I can go in and I can look at it. Sure, I could. I could basically show spheres and try to click on the atoms that I think are interacting. But it's easier to use pi mole selection tool to select what I want. And so let's go here, so we'll select interact. We'll put bi-res, which means if a single atom in a particular residue falls into this selection, it's gonna select the whole residue. So even if like the tail end, the C gamma of a valine is interacting with this, it's gonna select the whole valine residue. And I'll say within 5.0 from drug. And so this is saying to select all of the residues within 5 angstroms from this drug molecule. Now we can also add some other things, like perhaps we want to say, bi-res and not drug. So it's not going to select the drug molecule itself. And did that just totally not do anything? Yeah, I might need to put some parentheses in there. How about this? Not drug. Well, there we go. Okay, so we didn't do the bi-res. But now I can go in and I can select, or I can show it's gone in and selected every atom that's within 5 angstroms from any atom in this drug molecule. And so now I have a way to sort of look, okay, so arginine 87 clearly interacts, threonine 22 may interact, although it's not so close. Aspartate 21. So I can go in here and look to see what other residues are selected by that, you know, within or that distance-based constraint. Yeah, apparently I'm not using help. I'm not using bi-res enough, or correctly. Let's do this. Okay, so there we go. So that did it. So now we're selecting the entire residues and not just the atoms of the residues. And so if you want to sort of quickly draw an interaction surface or a set of interacting residues from something that you're interested in, you can use commands like this to show what those molecules look like. And so there's the command I ended up using. Okay, so this is PyMol. It's extremely powerful. Not only for making nice publication quality images, but also for doing types of analytical measurements that you might be interested in a protein that would be very difficult to do if you were just looking at the coordinates and trying to do calculations yourself. And so we'll see PyMol a little bit more in tomorrow's bioinformatics thing, how we can maybe align protein structures that you think are similar. In our case, the staphylococcal nuclei that we opened up, or nucleases that we opened up, were already pretty close to one another. But what happens when you open two proteins and they don't look close at all and they're separate in space? So PyMol has ways to do that too. But I'll give you guys an opportunity tonight if you want to play with the PyMol tutorial, get some familiarity with it, and then maybe you'll have it on your laptop for tomorrow that we could then work on some things together. Questions on what we've covered here? Okay. Well, our last session is Becca. I even gave her a little bit of time to prepare, and so she's going to talk about lab notebooks. And you guys can take a little bit of a break, and then she'll start up here in about 5 minutes or so.